This is the Human Rights 2020s podcast from the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This podcast is all about how we promote and protect human rights in Scotland. This podcast is a recording of a webinar around the incorporation of the right to rehabilitation from torture into Scots law and what that might mean for Scotland. The webinar was held on the 22nd of September 2020, and we hope that you'll agree that it's really thought-provoking, interesting and really timely discussion.
Welcome everybody. My name is Vari Snowden. I coordinate the Human Rights Consortium Scotland, which is a civil society network to promote and protect human rights. So we're delighted to have this webinar today, and particularly because it is very timely. For anyone who's been following human rights in Scotland over recent years, there's been a lot of discussion and pressure and desire to see human rights go further. So not just to stick at the international level, but to really bring them home and make them real. And that has only been heightened by, dare I say, the word Brexit and all the concern around rights going backwards, which we know is already happening, that there's a great concern to stop that tide in the wrong direction. And then obviously, in the midst of the pandemic, that we are more aware of human rights than ever before, I think. Human rights being restricted for all of us, but the particular impact on particular groups. So in the midst of all of that, some of you will know that there is a national task force that's been set up to look at developing proposals around a new human rights statutory framework for Scotland, which would basically bring more of those international human rights directly into Scots law. And just a couple of weeks ago, a bill to introduce the CRC, so on children's rights, into Scots law has been introduced into the Scottish Parliament. So there is a lot of discussion, there is a lot of debate. And what really the idea of this hour-long webinar today is to look at, well, what about this right to rehabilitation from torture? Where does that stand in Scots law? What could the impact be? What would it mean for Scotland? And we're delighted to have the real experts on this call who are going to tell us more about it. So the programme this morning is going to be some presentations first, and then we'll have time left at the end for questions, which can either be through the chat box or you can ask them directly. We are recording the webinar, but we'll cut out anyone who's actually asking the questions, so you don't have to worry about that, but that's just so that we can make the presentations available to those who couldn't make it this morning. So normal Zoom etiquette applies, so please mute if you're not speaking, and if you're not, we may take control and mute you, but don't take that personally. We're just taking control. So yeah, we are absolutely delighted to welcome our speakers. So what I'll do is I'm just going to introduce you all, and then we'll just go from one to the other, as that's okay, and come back to me. So first of all, we have Asgeir Kjærum. I'm not sure if I've actually said that right. I should have checked that in advance. Okay. Excellent. He's the Advocacy Director at the International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Victims, who's going to speak first and really set out what the right to rehabilitation is and means. And then Tracy Doig, who is the Head of International Advocacy and Accountability at Freedom from Torture. And we're going to really listen in on a conversation, I think, between Fiona Crombie, who is the Scotland Service Manager at Freedom from Torture in Glasgow, with Kolbasia Hasu, who is the co-founder and coordinator of Survivors Speak Out, which is a survivor-led advocacy network. So if it's okay, I'd say we'll go straight on to Asgeir first, and we'll go seamlessly one to the other, and then we'll have time for questions at the end. Okay, so I'll hand over to Asgeir now.
Yeah, so first of all, I would just like to really say thank you so much to all of you for inviting me to speak here today. It's a rare pleasure to not have to kick somebody's door in to speak about rehabilitation, but to actually be invited. So I'm very excited, and I'm really looking forward to this. I'm going to try to speak a little bit for around 10 minutes from an international perspective about primarily why it is important to have a right to rehabilitation incorporated into national law, and how one might do that. So what are some of the key features? But please remember that these are our reflections from around the world, and it is really to give you some ideas to reflect on to define what works best in the specific context of Scotland. So I've prepared a, a very short presentation that I will just switch to now. Let's start. My name is Asghar Kiram. I have worked for the IRCT for 13 years, working on promoting the right to rehabilitation for torture victims all around the world. The IRCT is an association of torture rehabilitation centers that was originally set up in Denmark as a response to Chilean torture survivors fleeing to Denmark from the Pinochet regime in the 70s. I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but a lot of our movement, including Freedom from Torture in the UK as well, was set up as a reaction to refugees coming from different Latin American countries. And what they all saw, the people who were sitting typically in Amnesty International chapters in different places in the world, were these people who came with incredible physical and psychological trauma, and that just continued. So where they started out was really the realization that when the violence stops, the physical and the psychological suffering of the victims does not end. It has maybe only started for many. So that was really what prompted the reaction to say, okay, as health professionals, we really need to come together and we need to find a way to help these people to rebuild their lives in the best way possible. So that is really since then the IRCT and the movement has grown to a global movement, but we still have many gaps. And I guess that's basically what we are actually discussing here today. So if you can go to the next slide. So just a few ideas about why it is actually important to start talking about and incorporating a right to rehabilitation. So if you just press one forward. So first of all, I think it is important, especially in these days where global institutions are breaking down, it is really important to remember that this is a right of people who have been tortured. It's not charity. It's not something that we are giving them. It is something that they have a right to receive as a response to the injustice that has been done to them, right? So that is really, for us, the primary reason why. And then if we go one more, the next issue is that it is also a global issue that has really an impact across countries. So in countries like Denmark and Scotland and the UK, we receive a lot of refugees that have been tortured, but that's not only it. We also have sent out soldiers to different countries that may actually be responsible for torture in those places. And thirdly, we also sometimes end up having situations where people have been tortured in our own countries. So for example, in Denmark, in recent years, there has been a case about massive abuse in childcare institutions going back between 10 and 40 years ago, where a lot of boys who were sent to these institutions were traumatized for life. So it is not only a refugee issue. It's not only something that happens in other countries. It is also something that happens here. And what we can see is that in the absence of an understanding that victims have rights to rehabilitation, rights to reparation, the public response is somehow surprising. So in Denmark, it took 10 years from the cases started appearing before the prime minister gave a public apology last year. And that was, of course, very welcome. But when some of the victims then came out and subsequently sued the government for compensation, the general public response was, but why would they do that? They got an apology. And then you could say, well, because the state destroyed their life. But that whole understanding that it is a problem everywhere that we need to be aware of, and it is not a question of charity, it is a question of giving people the rights that they have as human beings, a really essential element. Then the third, if you can move forward, Rebecca. So the effects of torture are not limited to the person who is assaulted. It travels through families, it travels through generations, and we can see in society that when we do well in terms of helping people rebuild their lives, we can stop that transfer and we can enable people to live fulfilling lives, either in their home country or in their host country. But when we don't do it, we can also see how these trauma continues. We can see as very current examples what is happening with Black Lives Matter in the US, where you have a very large part of the population that has been victimized and brutalized for centuries, and it has not gone away, right? People don't forget. So that, I think, for us is really the third key reason why this is an extremely important issue to raise and to focus on. And the last point is that we are actually extremely good at it. There is a very, very long history of developing better and better and better rehabilitation support practices all around the world. Freedom from Torture, who we will be hearing from in a sec, have an amazing experience in doing that, that they can share. So it is something that we should be proud of, and we can see that when people actually get help, we are very good at helping them make themselves better. So it is actually worth, from our perspective, really worth investing in. So that was a little bit of my sales pitch. And now to a few ideas of what are the key things that we need to think about when we then go into incorporation. And I'll be brief because I know I'm running out of time, and we have people with very interesting experience to listen to. So if you go one forward, Rebecca, I think first and foremost, the essential element is early and non-discriminatory access. So when we understand that until people get help, they go through an incredible level of physical and psychological suffering, you also understand that you cannot wait for years or for 40 years, which was the case in Denmark with the childcare facilities, before you actually start helping people, because the suffering doesn't stop. So that gives you, let's say, a good reason to make this something that happens very quickly. Number two, specialized services, providing support to torture victims, like other people who have suffered very deep trauma. It's not a light touch intervention. So we need to realize that however we structure a national system, it needs to focus on making sure that people have access to a broad variety of the relevant specialized services that they need. Number three, survivor involvement. So I will, Kolbasha, I'm sure will speak a lot more about this. I would simply say that one of the essential elements in the crime of torture is rendering a person powerless and then exposing them to something that they do not want. So when you start trying to help people rebuild their lives, if you do not help them take control over that process, you're replicating the violations that they have suffered. So I will leave it at that. Number four, something that from our perspective is extremely important. So when you are dealing with people who have suffered this kind of trauma, and it's not only torture victims, you can see the same with victims of rape and other things. There are a number of psychological responses that are very common, but that actually prevent people from engaging in traditional judicial and administrative processes. So we need to really think about how we design processes for accessing rehabilitation that enable people to claim their rights. So for example, things like applying statutes of limitation, when you know that it is very difficult for people to disclose within 5, 10, 15 years, it makes no sense to have a 5-year statute of limitation and then saying, okay, that's too bad, right? When you have processes that rely extensively on cross-examination and establishing credibility, but you know that some of the psychological trauma prevents people from recounting the same story in exactly the same way again. So these are things that one really needs to think about. How do we design a whole system that is actually welcoming and enabling for people? And then the last point is, especially when we sit in countries where, let's say, our governments are not the primary perpetrator compared to the number of victims that we will likely be supporting, it is extremely important to think about how can we include other elements of reparations and justice, even if it is not the traditional perpetrator government and victim relationship, but how can we help victims who flee to our countries get some kind of reparations, seek some kind of justice either through international systems or otherwise, but this is just such an important element in many people's recovery that we really have to think carefully about how to integrate that. So those are, for me, five really key markers to think about. And I'll just finish with a very short story that I think encapsulates the importance of all of this. So this man, his name is Manuel, and he is the dad of a very, very good friend of mine. And until around a year and a half ago, I knew him first as the dad of my friend, then as the grandfather of my friend's kids who have the same age as mine. I knew him as the pirate at the child's birthdays, as this really, really loving, caring man who was there to support his family. And that's it. Never thought anything else about him. Then a year and a half ago, he suddenly walks into my office because he wants to write a book about his history of being tortured in Bolivia, of fleeing to Denmark, of getting rehabilitation in the IRCT, and really rebuilding his life and being able to be a person who could raise a family and help be there for his children and so on. And it struck me that, you know, the success stories of rehabilitation, we never see them because they're just all around us everywhere. And so we forget about how much good we can do with this because it just blends into normal society and only focus on, let's say, the problems with refugees coming and so on. So for me, he is really the image of all of the good that we can create in this world if we enable people to rebuild their lives. So thank you so much for listening to me, and I look forward to discussing.
Thanks so much, Asker, as I personally feel incredibly much more informed and inspired, actually, and we'll discuss it and ask you some questions at the end. So, Tracy. So Tracy Doig is the Head of International Advocacy at Freedom from Torture.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for this opportunity to speak with you all today, and thanks, Asker, for your presentation. I'm going to keep my comments quite short to allow time to hear from the people on the front line, Fiona and Corbasia, and to allow for questions at the end. I just really wanted to, building on what Asger had said, is to reiterate the idea that rehabilitation is holistic. It's not purely about clinical interventions, but that actually, because it's helping torture victims rebuild their lives, it really needs to be a combination of services, so including medical, psychological, legal, and social support. And not forgetting the point that Asger mentioned is that it should be a process that supports the agency of survivors and empowers them and allows them to participate in the design. When it comes to the case of asylum seekers and refugees, there could be specific additional other services that could include assistance in documenting torture for their asylum decisions, as well as help in finding the whereabouts of relatives and connecting with them in the case of people who've had to be left behind. So this idea that it's really multiple interventions that are required to ensure that rehabilitation can be meaningful, that needs to be kept in mind, that Fiona and Corbasi, I'm sure, will go into more detail, but in conversations at Freedom from Torture we've had with survivors, rehabilitation has been defined as a number of aspects. Issues like independence, being able to freely move around, to be able to find work, to be able to open bank accounts, to have the sense of agency in your life is something that is an important aspect, as well as clinical support and medical support for any physical issues that still might be troubling people, as well as asylum and a speedy and process of asylum decision-making that allows people to move on with their lives, to have some sort of stability in their lives, and so that they are able to access and work through the trauma that they might be carrying with them. So as you can see, it's multifaceted. And the ability to enshrine the right to rehabilitation in law allows for a really comprehensive, cross-cutting program that factors in all these different aspects and allows for a holistic approach to allow for the optimal rehabilitation of people. as we keep saying, and as we'll keep on saying, and we'll keep on saying, is that because it's really vitally important that survivors are at the heart of this process, that by having a process that is enshrined in law, it will allow Scotland to really pioneer a progressive approach to working with survivors to design a cross-cutting range of services that are survivor-centered and survivor-guided. And I think that's an opportunity that really can't be missed at this point. My colleague Colbasio can go into more detail about the program because he's been intimately involved in it. But one of there's a project that's currently being piloted by Reed Smith, the international law firm, working in partnership with the Canadian government and UNHCR, as well as Survivor Speak Out Network that Colbasio is representing here today. They are working to pilot a new type of holistic resettlement and recovery and integration program for survivors of torture in Canada. And this is a project that is properly survivor-centered and survivor-guided and could be the kind of partnership that Scotland could look to introduce or work with as you go through this process. But I'm really going to stop there. As I said, I'm going to keep my comments brief, and I will look forward to any comments and questions later, and I'll hand over to Fiona and Colbasio now.
Hi. Colbasio and I had a bit of a thought about this presentation, and one of the things that we felt was it wasn't really fair for us to do two separate presentations, because the point of the principle behind rehabilitation is about integration. It is about sharing the journey between, in my position as a center manager and as a psychotherapist who provides therapy to a range of individuals who come to Freedom from Torture, and the mirror image is obviously the client, and Colbasio is in a brilliant place to reflect on his rehabilitation journey. And so we thought we could try and present as a conversation, which is a little bit strange over Zoom because we're 450 miles apart, but we'll give it a shot and we'll be pioneering and in the same spirit as the legislation. So what we thought we would just start about was just, Colbasio, I know that you've been primed to think a little bit about your rehabilitation journey, but I wonder if you want to start and share a little bit about your journey and what it's been like for you.
Thank you. First and foremost, I really want to say thank you very much for inviting me. And also, I'm really grateful that you even asked the webinar today, you know, thinking about that really important subject of, you know, the right to rehabilitation as such. So my journey or my experience started, I may say, very, very, very long time ago. But, you know, the time where I started looking into, you know, what is happening in my mind is when I reached UK. And when I reached UK, I felt there's a sense of, yes, you know, I reached somewhere safe and I reached a place where I may think that, okay, then what next for me in my life? Because, you know, the journey that took me from my home country to the UK is a long journey. And in that journey, there's so much sacrifice and so much danger that I went through it. And while I was going through it, I did not feel anything apart from the urgency of just, you know, going, just run away, find a safe place. And when I reached the safe place, that's when everything, you know, collapsed in the reality setting, basically. And I started experiencing so many things where I could not understand, I could not comprehend what's happening to me and why it's happening now. I don't see anything wrong with me mentally, why those things happening to me. And then, you know, instantly I was put in immigration detention center, part of the seeking asylum. And, you know, luckily for me, when I was released from the immigration center, I was referred to Freedom from Torture. And then I started, you know, the process of rehabilitation. And that process of rehabilitation took me about three to four years. But I started with one-to-one therapy, and then I was in a group therapy, and then I was in a football group, you know, therapy and so on. So, but the thing that I always said and I keep saying is that during that period of me having the therapy, I understood what was going on in my mind and why I suffer a nightmare, why I cannot sleep, why I have headache, why I have low mood, why I'm afraid, and all those kind of things. I understood, going through the therapy. Actually, there's nothing wrong, but it's not like any other sickness that, like mental health. But because one thing that I also want to emphasize, and then I will allow Fiona as well to comment in that, is that I come with that perception of, from my background education, is that, if you have problem with your mental problem, it means that you're possessed by the evil spirit. That's how it's addressed in my, back then. And I have that in my mind. So in the beginning, I have resistance a little bit on the fact of, sitting in a room, having one-to-one therapy and somebody talking to me and all those kind of things. So Fiona, I'm going to stop here and then allow you, to come in.
Kabasi, I was just thinking there, I was just reflecting on the principles that Asghar presented, and obviously we weren't privy to know what they were going to be just now. And I'm just thinking, how important what you're saying there about non-discrimination. And as psychotherapists, I'm going to say that non-discrimination is something that is taught, but being taught and experiencing for me are very different things. And one of the things that I know from my work at Freedom from Torture is that you do have to develop an amazing cultural understanding. And I think, you were talking about your culture that you were raised in and what their beliefs and understanding around mental health are. And there are many and varied, we work across a range of cultures. But I think it's those aspects of the process that are really important. And I think that if you've got a therapist, from my perspective, who can identify with those principles, and they're basic human rights principles, but so often I think processes kind of skip some of the micro parts and we just look at macro parts. So we have nice labels like trauma-informed services. And, we all have understandings of trauma, but, from listening to people's experiences, they're each one individual. We can make some generalizations, but your story is unique to you. And, I value and respect each individual story that I hear. And I think that's so important, that we don't get to a position of kind of tokenism or just holding on to the kind of big ideas, and we forget that the individual and their own unique experiences, or those crazy thoughts that people often share. They're saying, when I wasn't sleeping at 2 a.m, this is what's going through my head. Because they're as important as the coherent thoughts that they're having in the middle of the day.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think one thing that I really appreciate in using Freedom from Torture services, because I also use, there's a time where I use for a period of 2 years, the community mental health team as well, which, I was supported through my GP and as well. And I think one thing that's really important is the person-centered service, or survivor-centered or victim-centered, service. Why that is important? I think one thing that Asghar said in his comment in the presentation is crucially important related to torture. Is that, the thing that put people in a position to be tortured, I think I don't want to generalize, but most people, for example, my example, the thing that put you in a position to be tortured because you are involved somewhere. It's your involvement, whether that you see something in the community you're not happy with, you start speaking out, that's involvement. And in that involvement, you get tortured. And, next, when you're out of the torture, the first thing that you think about it, I don't want to get involved because I know the consequence of involvement. So to tackle torture is also to tackle that conception that somebody may have in their mind that, if I involve, it would be very difficult. But you need to design services which will involve people in making the decision of what meet their need. Because when we have experiences, yes, our experience is different completely. My experience is different to another person who has been tortured. But as a clinician, for you to understand that difference, too, for you to come down to the level of me you're working with is not the person that you worked with yesterday or the day before that is really important. Then that's the moment where you build the trust between you and the service user or the client or the victim or the survivors. I think it's really important. I cannot emphasize enough that in terms of rehabilitation, because also we need to touch on that. I think, you know, Tracy also, you know, highlighted that. And also, you know, two or three years ago, I ran a quick research to understand, because I don't want to think of my experience, that's what it is. But I want to ask other torture survivors about what rehabilitation mean for you. And, you know, the thing that come along very strongly is that, you know, rehabilitation is a journey and therapy is part of rehabilitation, and rehabilitation has no good end, because I think you relapse, but the therapy will give you the tool and the key that will allow you, when you relapse, you can go again. And that's why understanding as an individual and working in that individual level is really important for therapists.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think the other thing is just about the whole holistic nature of therapy. Because you said yourself, you had one-to-one therapy, you've had group therapy, Survivors Speak Out, I think, is still therapeutic as well. So, you know, I think In some ways, therapy is a vast and a vague term, but it is so important that, as you say, you listen to what an individual needs and what they feel are their priorities just now. And sometimes, you know, there are practical barriers, there are other barriers to them being able to access that. And I think, you know, making it accessible, something that they can swallow as well, because, you know, there's a lot of people who come and sit before me and share horrific stories, but there is still such a lot of uncertainty and instability in their life that they're not really able to make use of some of the tools and techniques that we can offer them. So it's offering them something that's appropriate to where they are on that journey as well, so that they've got the skills to come back at a future time and tackle, you know, processing some of the more challenging debilitating aspects of the torture and the trauma that impact on their day-to-day life. And, you know, I think the other thing that you said that was resonating is that therapy journeys have many, many agencies. So, you know, many of our service users come into contact with asylum support, housing providers, practical accommodation, welfare supports, freedom from torture, psychological therapy, ESOL groups with a supportive element. And, you know, it is about recognizing the individual and being a bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. If I may add one more point in, you know, what you just said, and also I think give the example that, you know, Tracy, you know, highlighted early, is that, because, you know, agency is something which take, you know, the survivor to the next level when come down to the therapy or to their, you know, rehabilitation. It's like, you know, it's like torture cover all the power or the confidence that you had before. Everything is covered. And you just need one thing that through that therapy or that rehabilitation to tell the person, oh yeah, you know, I can do that, you know, no, truly I can do that. And that's, if that moment come, you already unlock, you know, the door for that potential person to just move from up and going down. And that's why, you know, part of the therapy is really important, that, you know, you look at the where's the agency and also work with that agency. And that's the same principle where you read Smith and also the Canadian government with advocacy from the Speak Out Network come to that agreement that we need to look at the way the resettlement is being done for a very, very long time. And, you know, the way that, you know, the UNHCR decide everything and just, you know, give you the paper, okay, that's your resettlement plan and that you go. We need to look at it. And
I was just thinking about, I don't want to overstep there, but I was just thinking about resilience. We need to recognize individuals' resilience. That's a kind of therapy language for the concept that I think you're describing to us. And each individual has their own resilience and they need to be able to reconnect with that resilience because that's what's been robbed by the torture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I just realized that we, you know, the time.
Yeah. Will we draw things to a close and open our discussion to the wider audience? Any final comments? Well, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to share and we'll pass back to Barry.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. I have learned so much from that just in those last few minutes, actually. Really important messages around the importance of agency. And I really hear that message coming loud and clear around it must be holistic. It's not just one thing. It's a whole variety of things that the survivor themselves must be in charge of, actually, be able to design around that, and as well as lots of other things and messages in there. I just want to open it up for questions. So if anybody has any questions, if you could either put up a virtual hand or you can put your question just straight into the chat box and I'll ask them in a moment. But can I'll just take charge and actually ask you, can I kick off with a question first of all? And I think maybe this is for Fiona really. So I absolutely, that message of the whole range of supports and things that make up that right to rehabilitation and what's required. If in Scotland at the moment, are there gaps around that? Or is there an issue with people getting what they need and being in charge of that and having a say in what they get and what they need in order to rebuild?
I think so. I think one of the unique things about freedom from torture, for example, and Kobasi might be better to speak about CMHTs, is we provide therapy in clients' own language. There are very few services. As soon as you get into paying interpreting costs, services become very, very expensive, but they are also very, very effective. If people can access the therapy in the language that they're used to speaking, it makes it so much better for them. And I think that's woefully inadequate within the NHS. And I don't think it's a deliberate act. It's just telephone interpreting is the kind of norm in most GP surgeries. People being able, who have experienced torture or just trauma, being able to speak about that in a very short appointment without access to interpreting support, without feeling comfortable from the people that I work with isn't an effective intervention. So I think, you know, being able to have mental health support services in a variety of settings with a variety of expertise is vitally important. But definitely being culturally aware is also a significant part of that therapy journey or rehabilitation process. You know, it's well known, you know, I know that the needs of a variety of Scottish Government groups have recognised this as a serious issue. But sadly, I think one of the main barriers is not an unawareness, but it's the cost implications of it. So, and I don't know whether other people have the same experience, but that would be my kind of personal view.
Yeah, I think as we're looking at incorporating more international rights in Scots law, budgets are just so important, and there's a lot of discussion around how we actually make that real as well, like human rights into budgets, actually, so that we recognise what people need within that. So I'm just going to the chat. So from Casey McCall-Smith, so she's saying, governments are not very good with holistic approaches. What role should support organisations be in the holistic approach to rehabilitation? Are there good examples where NGOs and governments have worked together? And how is this actioned? Is it sort of law or is it policy? So some of what we're looking at in Scotland is putting this in law. Is it law or is it policy? Or I don't know, maybe Tracy or Asghar, maybe you have examples of where that's worked well or not well.
Shall I start and then maybe Tracy wants to join? I mean, there are two or three standard models that we see in use, and they have pros and cons. So I will just outline them very briefly because I don't want to take all the time on this. So there's one where you actually have, for example, in Denmark, where you have a mix of state specialized health services and NGO run health services that have then been certified by the government as kind of specialized health providers, right? And then victims can go where they want. And if they come, for example, to our member, which has that status, then they will recover the cost that they incur, right? So that, of course, gives you the possibility of having holistic services designed by NGOs. The issue is that there's very strong government control over how many hours of service and so on they can give. And at some point, the government decided, okay, we're going to restrict that because we need to save money. And then, you know, you can have all your holistic approaches, but if you don't have the money, then, you know, you don't. There are also models that use insurance-based models. And again, it depends on the design of the model and how much the insurances then sit with very restrictive approaches to what kind of service you can give and how much of it, right? So it isn't easy, but that's also why the legal design is so important in actually putting some of these principles, because they're not there, in at least not in Denmark and the other systems that we know, this idea of holistic, and because they're not used to dealing with people with this kind of problem, except, for example, with rape victims, but they are also given a horrible treatment. So it's actually, and that's also maybe an argument you could say, I mean, it's not only torture victims, and maybe these two fields could learn from each other and support each other. But I'll leave it at that, but I'm happy also to discuss on the side. Yeah.
Thanks, Asghar. Lee Bell, you're coming in next. So, Alison.
All right. Thank you. I work at Sahelia. Sahelia is a mental health organisation for BAME women. And I'll cut it really short, but I've got quite a lot to say. We work in 14 different languages regularly. Most of our 53 staff, 49 of our staff have got lived experience. We provide everything in 14 languages, and we can provide another 35 languages. And we train our own workers through a program on trauma, gender-based abuse, abusive cultural practices, so that we can be sure that everybody is working on the same model. Because a massive issue for us, apart from that there are no resources, that is very low level of awareness. I would say zero awareness in most NHS services, certainly not the resources. But when there is all of that, often services are provided by interpreting, who can actually re-traumatise and contribute to abuse, because they don't have a buy-in to social justice ethical framework, they haven't got an equalities framework, and there is no way of checking that. So it's not until we have our multilingual staff present that that's actually discovered. So we spend a lot of time telling the mainstream, this isn't working, you can't use interpreters. And we've set up our own language support and advocacy system because of that. So, I mean, we're not specifically there to support survivors of torture per se, but of our 1,100 plus service users that we support every year from 50 plus different countries, between 50% and two-thirds are survivors of FGM, which I would argue has the same impact as torture. And about 10% of those women are living with torture survivors, and so are vicariously traumatised. They're living with torture survivors who aren't rehabilitated, not getting support. So there's all those different issues. But resources are a massive problem. We have a holistic, trauma-informed, culturally aware support system tailored to the individual. But we have to fight for every penny. And we've got a model in Scotland which works for some of the most vulnerable, some of the most marginalised women in Scotland. But we have to fight for every penny. And we have to often compete with mainstream organisations for contracts and so forth. And we usually lose.
Thanks, Alison. And I think I hear that loud and clear, that actually, in some ways, we know what works.
Yeah.
But there's a resource issue. And I think what's interesting about that is, if we're looking at actually putting this right potentially into law, Could that make a difference in terms of that call on resources? It's quite a big question. Julie, do you want to come in there and say where you're from as well?
Thank you. I'm a counsellor in Angus, and this event actually came to me through Women for Independence. I'm really grateful to everyone for their input today and to Kilbasia in particular. I really liked what everyone was saying about that holistic approach, because I think quite often for people, going down a medical route is potentially quite dangerous and tricky. Trauma and PTSD, I think, are normal responses to horrific and abnormal experiences and incidents. And I think, you know, a lot of what we were talking about was child. My experience mostly is around domestic abuse and women in the criminal justice system. And there were a lot of similarities there. And I really think we need to make sure that training for frontline providers is integral to whatever we do, because there is not enough awareness around trauma and how each individual responds to trauma. It manifests itself in so many different ways. And my concern is we get people in silos just looking at an individual and, you know, discounting things or assuming things without that level of insight that provides an opening, I think, to explore that. So yes, a legislative approach, but it needs to incorporate that greater level of awareness raising. We just don't have that at the moment, and it's a real barrier to helping people access the services they need. And I can, you know, we just see this extrapolated throughout all these the areas that we've been talking about today. So I guess it was a comment more than a question, but, you know, we've heard around the third sector having the skills and the NHS waiting lists. I think it absolutely has to be a holistic approach and support available for people where they need it, where they are on their journey, and not go down necessarily that medical route. It has its place. Please don't get me wrong. I'm involved with various NHS services, but huge amount of investment required in that training part of it. And I really am concerned that that is going to be a struggle to achieve. I guess that probably fits well with what everyone else's experience is too.
Yeah, thanks, Julie. Yeah, there's loads of, I suppose it's that lack, a complete lack of awareness as well as a lack of resource and lack of services. I just, question from Janine in the chat box saying, so NHS services only offer narrow approaches, especially in working with trauma short term, and the research basis of working with trauma is very limited. The third sector have the skills and don't have the NHS long waiting list. How do we ensure that referrals are appropriately made to NGO specialist trauma services? I think Fiona might be on the spotlight again there, if you can, if you have any comments or thoughts on that from your experience.
It's a really interesting one, because I think it is a bit of a kind of million-dollar question, and that metaphor may not be entirely unrepresentative of some of the factors. I don't know about the other people that represent services here, but we have way more demand for our service than we actually have capacity. And again, that scales back to finance. Absolutely. I think the trauma-informed sector needs to get far better at providing evidence-based for trauma intervention. But there is a lot of research there. It just often isn't kind of gold standard. You know, it tends to be practice-based evidence. But I'm a great believer in what works for individuals and for us as therapists about getting better at claiming some of our successes. I think there's something about the personalities that we have and wanting to help people also. We don't want necessarily to shout about what we do. So I think we need to get a little bit better about how we speak about what we do. So just noticing that Janine had put another thing, mentioned in the chat there, our services, a specialist trauma charity. We don't receive many referrals. We do receive some. Well, I don't know what service she represents, but...
Sorry, would it be better if I just spoke?
Yeah, that might be easier. Sorry.
So I represent Wellbeing Scotland. We were formerly called Open Secret, and we've been a sort of specialist in working with trauma for 26 years. So We work specifically with people who were in institutional care, and a lot of them are survivors of torture because there was severe torture regimes within the care homes that they were raised in. So we are specialists in this area, and we've worked quite closely with the NHS over a number of years, but there's still that divide where even in the trauma training framework, it was written up that the specialist trauma services were within the NHS. But actually, that gives a very limited option, i.e. it's either CBT or some version of CBT or trauma-informed CBT that the therapy is for a lot of trauma survivors, which isn't holistic. And it's not looking at the individual needs of the people that you're working with who need that holistic wraparound, all-encompassing support. So my concern is that there's still that divide where even when the NHS are overloaded and have 18-month waiting lists, they still resist referring to the third sector, even though there are specialists out there. And within the matrix for complex PTSD or complex trauma, it's still only at the bottom level where it's only professional opinion rather than an evidence base.
Yeah.
So that's what really concerns me.
Yeah. Fiona, do you want to come back? I'm aware of the time. So
I almost kind of want to defend the NHS. I'm just thinking that the complex trauma service, certainly in Glasgow, are very happy to make referrals to the third sector and do frequently. And, you know, we do have a kind of collaborative model of working. So I think there are opportunities just to build relationships and to try and support that. Making it more generalised is a huge challenge.
So can I come in there? Because I realise that the time, if everyone's just got a few more minutes, because I feel like I don't want to miss Elaine's question, if that's okay. So Elaine said, thank you to all the speakers. I think there's a really promising opportunity in Scotland at the moment that could have an impact on a cultural and political level beyond the core aim of protecting our right to rehabilitation. A question for Asghar or Tracy. Are there any very recent international law developments that we should be aware of? And what is the current best example, in your view, of a textual provision on a right to rehabilitation? Asghar, do you want to come in first? Or?
I'm not aware of any recent international law developments beyond General Comment 3 by the Committee Against Torture, which goes into a lot more detail about what rehabilitation means and what the right to rehabilitation should go into. In terms of a textual approach, in my kind of reading on this, and I must admit not, and so perhaps Asghar could have more detail on this, as far as I'm aware, the United States is one of the only countries that has the right to rehabilitation in law, including the right to rehabilitation for people who've been tortured elsewhere and not only in their country. Other countries do have the right to rehabilitation enshrined under torture law, including the Philippines and Chile, I believe, and some other countries that you could argue are states that torture their own citizens. But I must be honest to say that I have not done enough research to know how well the American law is implemented in practice, as opposed to how it's enshrined in the law itself. But the Torture Victims Act is perhaps a model that could be used. Asghar, do you have anything?
I'm going to be very brief, and I'm really happy to support this process moving forward, so this doesn't have to be the end. Like textual examples, most of the good ones are from countries that have massive torture problems themselves. So the focus of the law is maybe not what would be needed in Scotland, because it has a very extensive focus on investigating claims and stuff like that. But one could definitely look, and then they don't have the refugee component, right? To my understanding, the US only has the refugee component, which is very, I think in many ways, very good, but they actually don't have it for their own citizens. But I'm not an expert in US, so need to look into that. But that is the thing. There are a lot of partial examples, and I guess the trick is to kind of find a way to combine that. Just one other point. I mean, international law developments, they will take me forever to explain, and they're maybe not so important right now. But I think there is an important point overall, which is about raising awareness amongst, I mean, okay, for lawyers especially, but not only, but also, you know, white, heterosexual, privileged men like me, it is really, really hard to imagine what it is like to suffer from trauma, to be exposed to these kind of things, to be a refugee, and so on. And that means that the systems, when they are faced with some of this information, they are in complete disbelief. They can simply not comprehend that somebody would be unable to tell the story of their abuse when it is so important for their asylum claim, right? I met an ex-girlfriend in the street on my bike and who works in the Immigration Refugees Appeals Board. And I just told her, so remember to be nice to the torture victims today. And she said, but they all say they're torture victims. And then I said, well, maybe they all are torture victims, you know, but for her, yeah. So there's this complete disbelief. And so making sure that the legal profession and the public systems understand what trauma is and understand how many people are actually potentially suffering from this, I think is a key element, no matter how. And the law can help with that because it can put some of those markers in. So that was just something that struck me with many of the comments that have come in the chat as well. So yeah, but I'm really happy to help moving forward if there's anything I can do.
Thanks. I think I'm very aware of the time and people probably have other places to go. In fact, some folks already have. What we will do after this, we're going to put together a short paper on around the right to rehabilitation and what it could mean for Scots law. But we'll also capture some of those questions that we've asked already and some others and put together a little bit of a sort of answering of questions and for sure consult with experts. So Asghar and Tracy and Fiona and Kobasi will be in touch on around some of those answers. Of course, the recording of the speakers will also be available afterwards if you want to send it on to any other contacts you have. And very much in Scotland, there is a lot of work, obviously, that's going on already. But in some ways, this is the start of a discussion about, okay, so what does this mean in terms of our law then? Well, what does it mean for what needs to be in there? How do we raise awareness? How do we make sure that all of the range of supports are available so that people can rebuild their lives? I'm very aware that it's almost rebuilding because of man's inhumanity to man. We need to actually come and say, actually, we will make it a human right in practice that people have what they need to rebuild and recover and to live their lives to the full in Scotland or wherever they end up after that. So I hope that's been interesting for everybody. As I say, we will be in touch with those things. And can I just say a huge thank you to our speakers? I feel really privileged to have such expertise here in this Zoom room. So I really thank you so much. Thanks for taking the time and bringing your expertise. So thanks to Asghar and Tracy and Fiona. And I know Kobasi has left. I'll email them again, say thank you as well. So thank you. And we'll be in touch. So have a good day.
Bye.
Thanks.
Brilliant.
Thank you, everyone.
Very nice to meet you.
Bye-bye. Thanks.